Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. This is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. Yes, it is Saturday the 27th, and another month is over with. I can't believe how fast this year's going by, but that's what everybody says. In the world of Earth Ancients, civilizations from the past, there's constantly, I'm getting constant information, I'm people are sending things in to me. I'm always looking around for what is new, what is fascinating. And remember, Earth Ancients is part of the Facebook Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. And so they relate to each other. And I always encourage listeners to go to Facebook, punch in Earth Ancients, and find the page. The page has some of the most, not only current discoveries, but discoveries in the last 20, 30 years, and my own research into Central and South America. I've had a fascination with the Maya for probably 20 plus years, and I have quite a bit of documentation that I post on a weekly basis. I've reported over the course of a good year and a half, the new technology known as LIDAR scanning technology and what it is doing in the hands of archaeologists. I posted it's actually a couple of days ago, it's the LIDAR technology that has been used in Angkor Wat in Cambodia. And what's fascinating about this is that what they do is they basically hook this scanner up onto a helicopter or a small airplane, and they fly over an area that they think has larger ruins that are uncovered or just current ruins, and just to see if they're missing something. And a group of scientists actually flew over Angkor Wat in Cambodia a few months ago, and discovered intricate roads, floor plans, buildings that they had never known about before. And this technology is just revolutionizing archaeology because it actually can pick up unknown construction. And what has been discovered, and this is posted, by the way, the title is LIDAR scanning technology is changing the way we see ancient Earth. And the fascinating thing about Angkor Wat is we thought it was just a central series of buildings, and then there was a moat around. It was cut around the perimeter of the central complex. But what it's turning out, what they've discovered is there's a whole region that is much earlier than the central construction. And there's roads, there's buildings, there are actual ruins that apparently could be significantly older, which would redate the entire place. Which, when you look at most of the prehistoric buildings 3,000, 4,000 years and older. Typically, the ancients built on earlier, on top of earlier construction. We know this from the Maya. The Maya had a tradition to sanctify earlier ancestors' construction, and they either built on top of pyramids or built complete complexes on top of earlier buildings and construction. And so it appears that in Angkor Wat, this is the same kind of a situation where there's earlier construction that has come to light. So take a look at that. That's been out for a couple of weeks, and that is really a fascinating discovery because it really shows us that, that our dating is probably inaccurate and that we need to look a little deeper into some of these ancient ruins. I also would suggest that you look at the ruins of Muyul, Yucatan, Mexico. There is a fascinating stone sculpture that someone sent me. It's funny because I've always, you know, when I'm down in the Yucatan, haven't really been to the Muyul area, and it's very close to Coba, which is a massive city, many miles square, south of Cancun, very close to Tulum, which is on the Caribbean side of Yucatan Peninsula. But the unique part of this sculpture is it was covered for many years and was not known to have been there, and it's part of a huge altar. And these figures appear to be from the underworld. And the title of the posting, which is just a couple of days ago, is Sacred Mayan Maya Sculptural Wall, Muyul, Yucatan, Mexico. And the unique part of this is that it's cut in limestone, and the figures look at you, and there's one figure that is, I think, the main focal point, and he's quite fabulous. he looks kind of like down and out from his cave chamber. So so much of the Maya sculpture has been damaged because of sun and erosion, and because this was covered, it's been protected, and it's a great opportunity to see what some of the stone masonry was like thousands and thousands of years ago. So take a look at that. There's also quite an interesting pyramid that's very close to this sculpture, and I think one of our members has posted a photo when she was down in the area that is kind of fun to look at. The last thing I want to bring up is out-of-place artifacts. And as you all know, I have a great deal of problem with the ancient alien hypothesis. And in short, the ancient alien hypothesis is used to explain the megaliths of Cusco, Sacsayhuaman to be exact, which is just above Cusco, the massive walls that make up the central complex. The ancient alien hypothesis is used to explain Baalbek, Lebanon, this massive 800 to 1,000 ton megaliths that are used as the foundation stones, and on and on and on and on. And I think people, and unfortunately our historians, Western historians, do not look at our ancient past. The Hindu yugas speak of human cycles in the millions of years, as well as the Vedas. The Chinese have writings that go back hundreds of thousands and millions of years. And yet, when we discover these megaliths that are cut in, with a high level of precision, and not just these megaliths. We're talking Giza Plateau. The Great Giza Pyramid is thought to have been created by aliens. I think there's even been episodes where they consider the Sphinx as a possible alien in construction. I mean, it's gotten out of hand, and so I've posted these intriguing questions about ancient Earth, and there's a post that I put up called "How Old Is Earthman? Intriguing Questions After Discovery," and the post is actually a fascinating rock that was discovered just north of Moscow, in which you can see plain sight of a screw and a bolt that is embedded in a rock. So the rock, it was dropped into some mud or something like that, and over millions of years, it calcified, and now the rock is was opened up, and you can see a man-made screw and drill bit points and things like that. And you know, it can't be explained. It just mystifies scientists, because when you date the rock is millions of years old. Actually, I think this rock is 100 million years old, which really throws a wrench in the whole theory of ancient man. But, I mean, this is what Earth Ancients is all about, and this is why I've been passionate about the subject for so many years, is that the Mayan elders, the Hopi elders, and the various indigenous people of the Americas have told me personally, the shaman and the day keepers, Mayan day keepers, that Earthman has been around millions of years. And because it's not documented, because there are no written records, it's just poo-pooed. And so this gives the ancient alien theorists great opportunity to say, look, these are megaliths. There were no people around at this time. It must have been aliens. Well, it doesn't wash for me, and I have a great deal of challenge with that. Now, that being said, I will say this too, that in the Hopi tradition, and we've had a couple of writers, authors on our program who have actually written books about Mayan and Native peoples' mythology and oral traditions of star people. And star people are ETs. They are aliens who came down and mingled and settled in various parts of our world. And I don't disprove that aliens, or I don't, excuse me, not disprove, but I don't feel that they've never been here. It's just that to say that they are the builders of these megaliths, of these complexes, the various places around the world, is alien. It's just, no, it doesn't work for me. So, but they've been here, and they may still be here. So, but that's a whole different website. That's a whole different subject. So anyhow, I think you get the sense of where I'm coming from on this subject. Today's guest is quite a unique individual, and we're going to talk about South America, specifically Peru. William Veal is the author of Portraits of the Gods, which is a book that I discovered, I think, about a little less than a year ago. And he's a new author. And he has studied engineering in Southampton College of Technology, and he also studied archaeology, environmental science, Spanish at the University of Southampton, UK. His primary subject was archaeoastronomy, and he had a number of cross disciplines: archaeology, anthropology, ethnology. And he researched Portrait of the Gods for a number of years, and it brings up a lot of interesting subjects, because what he's discovered, it appears that there was a lot of European influence thousands of years ago in South America. And William is coming to us today from... Actually, William, where are you calling from today? How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Cliff. I'm calling from Catalonia, which is to most people Spain, but we are in fact
Spain.
An independent country. Spain, yeah.
Ah, okay, beautiful. Well, let's talk about this book. You start from the beginning. Let me know. You know, let us know what was the impetus, the initiation for you to start writing this book.
Oh, sure. Okay, Cliff. Well, actually, it's a long story, and it's more than 40 years long, in fact. I was employed in scientific instrumentation for, close on 18 years, and I eventually left to join a small management consultancy business. It was at this company that, pardon me, my PA offered to lend me a fascinating book she's just read. Well, one glance at the title told me it was just not my type of reading material, so I politely said, thank you very much, put it in my office desk, and promptly forgot it. A couple of weeks later, she asked, rather sweetly, if I enjoyed Chariots of the Gods. Much embarrassed, I had to tell her, well, no, I hadn't had time to read it, which at the time was a pretty lame excuse, I must admit.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually...
You did get a chance to read it, huh?
I did get around to reading it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, reluctantly. Yes, I did. Although I have to admit, my days of reading science fiction had long gone by, and I'd barely heard of archaeology and the unspoken word in those days, archaeoastronomy. I'd never heard of it either. However, I fell for Nicole's very soft, persuasive French accent, and I promised her I would read the book cover to cover that weekend. So mm-hmm. I duly returned the book with a rather tongue-in-cheek, and I said, I found the content very interesting, although I now confess I'd not really digested 99% of it. However, being naturally very inquisitive, and this will answer your question, one element kept buzzing around my mind. There was a reference to something called the Nazca Lines. Now, the one thing I found strangely at that time was scant attention had been paid to the real reason behind this monument, this 500 square kilometer panorama of somewhat dubious origin, except, of course, by a few dreamy fantasists desperate to prove that the lines and geoglyphs were not really of earthly origin, the aliens you were talking about. So it was more out of curiosity than a desire for educated learning, I guess. I began to devour anything I could find on the subject. And you know what? I was amazed to find, Cliff, that this monument of artistic wizardry was strictly taboo in the eyes of the archaeological establishment.
So let's talk a little real quickly. The Nazca lines were of great interest to you. So did you go on from there what led you to writing Portrait of the Gods? Was it specifically the Nazca lines or just the contents within the book or what?
Yes, it was the Nazca lines was my fascination of the rectangles, the triangles, the lines, the animal figures. And I was very, very curious as to who produced them in the first place. And but what really led me to it is the fact that when I was surveying the Nazca lines, I found a rectangle, we call them trapezoids, and it was a cleared area, and it had small heaps of stones all over it. And I was a very curious person, and I looked and I wondered why these stones were set as they were. Anyway, I did some work over a few weeks or so, and I found that they appeared to be like an inscription. So I sent this inscription to a rather eminent epigrapher, who, to my great astonishment, he immediately translated it. Well, you can imagine, here I am in the middle of the Nazca lines, thinking it's produced by the Nazca culture, and the guy comes back and says, William, I'm sorry, but it's 3rd to 4th century Phoenician. And so this was the first inscription ever found, of all places, in the Nazca Lines. But the object of my curiosity with the Nazca Lines was who produced them. So this inscription gave me the key that opened the door to transoceanic contact with South America. And of course, that is also my first part of the jigsaw puzzle was in place. Someone other than the Nazca culture had left a deliberate, indelible mark on this particular spot of the Desert Pampa. So this is what excited me suddenly, that the fact that the Nazca culture, they had a limited life period, they were had no form of writing whatsoever, therefore they couldn't have put the inscription there or copied a Phoenician inscription. So that kind of let them out of the circle, and then off I went to search in other areas to look for more images and to back up the fact that the Phoenicians had been on the Nazca Pampa.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit. You wrote an article early in this period called Southern Evening Echo. And,
yeah, correct.
Yeah, tell us about that and why that's an important article.
Well, it is very important because in my excitement of having found something on the Nazca Lines which was strange, I felt that I wanted to go to the site. I wanted to advertise what I'd found and to try and attract some interest. So I wrote to the Southern Evening Echo, and they published it almost immediately. And suddenly, within, I say, 2 days, I had a reply from the Southern Evening Echo. And one of the archaeological unit from the Southampton University archaeological team, they wanted to come and have an interview. So I said, well, yeah, okay, fair enough. And along they came. Well, basically the person who in the end became my friend, and I know still communicate, said, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, this is not really our interest. We're not interested in the Nazca Lines. This is all very, very alien. But if you wish, carry on. And, you know, goodbye and good luck. So I was not going to be given up by that. So I promptly decided that I would go down to Peru myself, and I would have a trance around to see who knew about the Nazca Lines, what they looked like. So, well, I made my first expedition to Peru in, I think it was about December 1980. I'd already prepared a list of contacts in rather high places. And one lady in particular was called Dr. Rosa Noriega. And I popped round to her premises, and she agreed that she would look at my research material. And almost immediately she said, oh, I recognize this image. And she said, where did it come from? I said, it's on the middle of the Nazca Lines, and it looks rather like a coypu. And she said, no. She said, it's a cabrito. So that was the second surprise I had, that on the Nazca Lines there were drawings of real animals as opposed to the figures.
What is a cabrito, William?
A cabrito, it's a young goat, a baby goat, a kid.
Okay,
kid.
So...
yeah.
So this scientist, Noriega, actually identified one of your photos as...
images.
As that, yeah, okay.
Yes,
so
indeed.
She had actually...
Yes, indeed, she did.
Mm-hmm. Let's go
she
back just a second.
Yeah.
Let's just go back a second. Now, what... had you been received your diploma when you wrote this article in this newspaper? What was the reaction to the by the establishment?
No, in actual fact, I'd researched it privately, and I hadn't started university until some years after, as I went in as a mature student. So this also, I had been going to university to study environmental sciences, So I was familiar with the university and the archaeological unit, of course. And I was very surprised when the doorbell rang and the guy appeared and said, I'm interested in what you're doing. But it was just the problem of, at that time, archaeoastronomy was not talked about very much. It was all transoceanic and therefore not really possible. And no one had done any work on it at all. So, in fact, you know, one didn't talk about it too much. So, okay. In fact, I doubt very much, Cliff, if there was more than a handful of scientists brave enough at that time to risk their careers by challenging the notion and introducing, well, dare I mention the word, transoceanic influence. So there yeah. I was, presenting myself to this extremely important scientist, saying all about transoceanic, da-da-da-da. But at least she was very kind. She gave me a good interview and identified the Cabrito. Anyway, while I was in Peru, I went down to the Servicio Aeronautico Nacional, which is the Air Force base at Barranco. And knowing that they had taken many photographs of the Nazca lines, I completely impromptu knocked on the door, went in and said, hello, and I would like to look at your files on photographs and, if possible, purchase them. And anyway, mm-hmm. they were absolutely wonderful gesture. They gave me access to the photographic archives. And hey presto, I came away with a dozen completely unknown photographs. And I thought it was a wonderful gesture for someone like me, an Englishman, completely unknown to them.
Yes.
And finally, just to finish off the story, I dropped by the Lima Times newspaper, and the editor, who was Mrs. Doris Gillespie, she said, yeah, I'll give you an interview immediately. She wrote an editorial, and she even published my Cabrito and in the paper. So it was also published in Lima. So that's the
wonderful.
Story of how it built up from the Nazca lines. And once I had this information and the contacts at Barranco, that I knew there was something somewhere that I had to keep going.
Okay. So this is all happening. This is happening in the about early 1980s.
This is
correct.
1980s. Yeah.
Okay. So from I understand from your bio, you were really not engaged in archaeology at all at that time. But you were concentrating on your commercial interests. Is that correct?
That's quite correct, Cliff. I guess at the time I was thinking long term, like I know what I'm going to do when I retire. So, however, without filling in a lot of personal history, I'll cut to the chase and go to a point where the many years of concentrated part-time research, I was still doing part-time research, even though I was running my own commercial businesses, it began to bear fruit, and I was more and more confident that there was something behind the Nazca lines other than what we already knew. But so back in those days, which was, 1974, I guess, I was always very confident that the Nazca lines were astronomically aligned, and that the Nazca culture did not have the longevity or the astronomical knowledge to have constructed the very, very sophisticated Nazca lines. So, as I said, there must have been some kind of external input. And with the inscription, I briefly found an input. But as I say, I doubt at that moment in time there was more than a handful of scientists who would even whisper the word transoceanic influence. So I had to paddle my own canoe from there.
So in your book, Portraits, when you came across this inscription in the middle of the Nazca line, it's common knowledge that the Nazca culture had no form of written communication. So how did you come up with Phoenician writing? That's a curious
theory. What I did actually is I sent a copy of the inscription to one quite famous epigrapher, just spitting in the wind, really. And immediately he came back, and not only did he look at it, he actually translated it. And the translation was extremely interesting. I also actually sent it to another Spanish epigrapher who came back with the same comment that they were 3rd to 4th century Phoenician script. And I can remember off by heart now exactly what the inscription says. And it says, and this is where it's very interesting, connection with the old world. Come, carve, that means to dig, down into the earth and spread, strain and pacify the waters in this area. Remember, the desert was very, very dry, lack of water. And come and spread within your region grace. Go out among the land, that's the peoples, and become strong. Now, that is very, very interesting that that particular inscription could be totally translated without any question that it came from Phoenicians. And so this was my positive connection with Phoenicia.
And this specific hieroglyph, is it in the lower plains where the animal figures are, or is it upper plains of Nazca, of that
well,
flat area?
Yes, originally the lower plains where most of the figures are, the San Jose area, but this one is more towards Palpa. But we now know in the Palpa region there are just as many figures as there are in the lower plains. So to answer your question, really, it's now in the upper plains. So maybe they went to live in that area and were working for that area because there's obviously water there as opposed to the lower regions.
Okay. And a theory for the date is this 3,000 plus years ago that would have been inscribed in the lines, or is there kind of a date that you can give to that one hieroglyph?
It's speculative, really, Cliff, because we know the writing is 3rd to 4th century Phoenician, 3rd to 4th century BC, but the one thing you don't know, because you need to examine the artifacts surrounding the inscription, and this hasn't been done yet because of the lack of permission to get onto the lines. So whether there is any, in quotes, Phoenician artifacts that can say positively the Phoenicians were there, or someone else wrote it, maybe someone else knew Phoenician and they popped over and, you know, scribbled on the desert and went back home. So we don't know from the artifactual evidence, but it's fairly, fairly certain with the other things I've discovered and the other Phoenician inscriptions running from the various valleys up to the high mountains, which we'll look at again in a moment, and I'll cut to the chase very quickly. And there's no doubt the Phoenicians were there. There's just another point to raise. Alongside the particular inscription, there's two images which you can see in my book, and one I actually call the goddess, and the other one the dynast. One is Greek, and one is Chinese. So the anomaly now arises that not only did I find the inscription in Phoenician, not far away is a image, a huge image, which, as I say, we call the dynast, and that is the Orient, an Oriental, obviously Oriental, and right alongside the Oriental is what I call the goddess and the lioness, and again, you can see them in my book, which, of course, is a copy of a Greek 5th century sculpture, and because it has the lioness at the shoulder, we know this is probably Athena, because, therefore, she is the huntress in the sky, as you know. So that was three additional factors that convinced me I was on the right track, and there was no way I was going to give up from that point on.
Okay. It seems that for a while you're using aerial photography. When did you start using remote sensing satellite photography in your research?
I started I think it was the year 2000, and there was a reason that I had to start this, because there's the lack of aerial photographs spanning the Nazca Desert. So obviously I was still working within that region, looking for more images, perhaps of Phoenician or Greek or Arabic, whatever. And the problem was the photographs that you had did not link all of the other geoglyphs. So you didn't have an outside association as to which trapezoids, which rectangles, which figures perhaps linked with the material that I'd discovered. So in other words, my area of research was extremely small. So luckily for me, along came satellite technology in the form of Google Earth. And, well, this opened up a whole new world to me. It was a world that you couldn't possibly dream of. And you were covering the whole of the Nazca lines in one quick pass. And so it was, I'm just looking at my notes, about the year 2000 that I first started work and first started discovering more images using the satellite technology. It was an absolute godsend, mm-hmm. I can assure you. Apart mm-hmm. from being able to capture the images, the, as you know, Google Earth also has a measuring device, so I could make measurements of the sizes of the images I discovered. It also mm-hmm. will tell you the azimuthal information, the directions, whether it's pointing to sun, the moon, or certain stars. And so, again, this helped me analyze the area that I was working in. And so, yes, it was an absolute godsend. And from that point on, I've actually discovered, well, more than 100, which we will see as we just get rather through the text here.
Okay. So here's a question that is a little off the main theme here, and it's been a question of mine. The Van Doniken states that the original Nazca lines were cut in for viewing from elevations. And what that means to him and most of his readers is that spaceships, aircraft of all types use these for landing fields. They were cut as signals, as reference points for various people in craft. What do you feel about that? What do you feel about the Nazca lines and your figures? Because as I see it in your book, a lot of these figures are only available from an elevated point of view. And why
Right.
would you
Yes.
cut these intricate reliefs on the ground, you know, many, you know, hundreds of feet across if they were not made to be seen from an elevated flying position? So tell me what you say about that.
Well, my theory is quite straightforward. They cut the figures to a very large size because that's one way they could communicate with the gods. So it was a communicating device for the gods. I don't have anything to say about aliens. I have never published anything on aliens, and I do not include it in my work. So Daniken and I totally disagree. And the other thing is, if you can see them from high ground, and there is a situation which I'll quote to you a little bit later on, whereby in mythology you always read, and the high priests went to the high places to communicate with the gods. So again, you have this height factor coming in. And so, A, you can possibly see some of them from the mountaintops, but the object basically was to communicate with the gods, and you had to draw them as large as you could to prove to the gods that you could actually do this. And then of course we again will see a little bit later on in the Temple of the Sacred Lamb that's where the priests went to the high ground. No, Cliff, I'm sorry, I don't have anything to do with aliens, I'm afraid. I do read it occasionally, but I believe there could well be or have been a civilization earlier than the civilization we're talking about, especially when we come to the point of the imagery I've discovered. It just leads to the fact that before that there could have been a technical civilization, but I only work on pure facts at the moment. But I'm fascinated by your particular program when you come up with these little screws, you know, which are in rocks 11 million years old. But I do have my own opinion why it got there, or whether, in fact, it really is a screw and not a worm of some kind. But that's digressing very slightly.
So in your opinion, the Nazca lines, these animal figures, and now your discovery of these various mementos to the gods, the goddesses, were cut to be seen in the local mountains looking down to commune with the gods and the goddesses. Is that so you don't feel there's any period in time unknown to current man where there could have been an advanced culture that actually did use devices to fly above the, and I'm not speaking of aliens now, I'm speaking of Earth humans that may have that may have been earlier periods.
I'm a little bit of a purist, Cliff, and I have to say, unless I find a jet plane and a pyramid, I would take a lot to be convinced. Quite honest, I haven't got that far. I'm taking the spiritual route, where the larger you draw something on the surface of the earth, you communicate with the gods in the universe, and that's the device that they used. In actual fact, I have to say that if you care to read some of my blogs, you will follow up on this theme of the gods in high places, and I even touch on Atlantis. I'm not averse to touching on Atlantis, although I must admit there is some very strange stories that have been written about Atlantis. But maybe we could do a program in some other time on Atlantis, because it is very, very interesting. And it is a follow-up, actually, Cliff, on this imagery. So I think you would find it very interesting. Okay.
Let's talk about what you have discovered and what you published in your book. You have people from the Orient, people from that appear to be Greek, and of course you have identified Phoenician inscriptions. What have you found? Tell us a little bit about some of these people that you've discovered.
This is the imagery. Well, I've discovered more than probably 100 of the individual images, not of all of them, of course, in portraits of the gods. But those portraits, firstly, they are real satellite images. Not one single one has been enhanced in any way. They are exactly as the Google Earth satellite captured them on the Earth. Now, the second thing I just mentioned is, they are intaglios. That means they are bas relief, carved into the side of hills, into the banks, into the flat plains. They are not necessarily 3D statues. This has a definite reason, because they kind of parallel the figures that are on the desert itself. They are 2D. These are bas relief, 2D. We would love to go and film them, turn them into 3D, but that's something we're working on in the future. So how do I know who they are? Well, it's a really what you have to do. You have to do a little bit of identity determination. Now, firstly, they're very beautifully sculptured, so they're very classical. And after 3,000 years or so, they are in superb condition. So when you're looking to analyze where the people may have come from, who they may be, there are lots of things you look at. A lot of the toning on the face is still exists on a lot of them. So they may be pink skins, or light brown, or dark brown, or black skins. And we have found Negroes. You look at the headwear, and that's a great giveaway, especially with Greek headwear. If they have helmets, as you can see on your page, that's a warrior. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they had a protective regime. And this is basically protection because of the Great Highway and the transport of gold and silver and copper. So they were a warrior team as well. And they probably kept the locals under control, because the locals wouldn't like all their goodies going away. And so that's two things. And then if you look at Sephirina and you look at Divine Consort, have a look at their hair, have a look at the jewelry, have a look at the rings in the hair and the neck pieces. Now, all of that can tell you that they were not pre-Columbian ladies or men. They were from another part of the world. And if you compare, say, Divine Consort or Sephirina particularly, the Egyptian ladies did wear those type of jewelry and hair pieces in their hair. So we know that they are not pre-Columbian people.
Interesting.
And just finish one thing. If you look below the four photographs that you have on your webpage and the reproductions by Marthia, now Marthia hasn't altered the pictures in that sense. What she's done is she's brought an image up to date as what she feels, for example, like Sephirina would have looked like as an Egyptian lady, and possibly even 3,000 years ago, the image carved on the hillside or on the cliffside, it probably had more jewelry, more hairstyle. So Marcia, which you can check up on the Chimas Studios in Florida, and she is now going to work on more of our imagery so that we can silhouette a lot of the images in the next book which we're producing. Because in Portraits of the Gods, we're still talking about the imagery, you'll notice there are some images which are a little bit fuzzy and some which are delightfully clear. Now, we did not touch any of the poorly produced photographs because we want to show people that is what we found and we did not touch a thing. So you have the two. But what we now want to do is we want to do a line drawing perhaps or a silhouette so that people can immediately get the orientation of the image. We have found a little difficulty in someone saying, well, I don't know which way she's looking or he's looking. And so we're putting some orientation details in the next book. Because I must have something like 200 now different images that I need to put on a polyglot, which I will publish as a separate little book there.
200, are you saying you have 200 portraits that you've discovered?
Of various types, yes. Yeah, I've got two registers, of which the item number on my third register is now 2,109, but that includes lots of different inscriptions. There are hundreds of inscriptions everywhere, and my bank of imagery is growing, I was going to say by the day, but I've eased up a little bit now because I'm too busy doing other things. But if you look in your book, you've got the human-headed Talios, then you've got these wonderful Gorgons. Now, there's another interesting thing about the Gorgons. We were talking about Greek just now. Now, these Gorgons are basically all in one place, and so they appear to be perhaps Greek workers were building the highway, and I think they're rather fun. They've got happy smiley faces, and they could have even been doing copies of themselves. But what is interesting, beside each of the Gorgons, there is a thing called an Olene, and you're a man of Maya and Aztec, so you'll know straight away that the Olene in the Aztec world has got a meaning, which is direction or wind. And so the origin of the Olene was Greece. It is a Greek origin. So we now have an association along the Great Highway with the Greeks. And also the other connection, and I'm sure again you know this, that Medusa was this beautiful fair maiden who committed certain indiscretions, and the gods changed her into an ugly, ugly old lady with snakes in her hair. And so hence the expression, the Gorgon. And so we now have another connection with Greece. So again, we know Phoenicians and Greeks were there. Mm-hmm. And as I said,
I want to give our audience a chance to ask some questions. So if you have a question for William, please, all you have to do is call in. It's 347-826-9565. And when you call, just press 1 on your phone, and I will call on you. So 347-826-9565, press the number 1 on your phone, and I'll call on you. Now, I'm also able now to take questions on Facebook or Twitter. On Facebook, just go to earthancients.com on Facebook, or Twitter is earthancients, and just ask me a question, and we will pose it to William. This is fascinating, William, fascinating. Let me quote you at this point. After you have made these discoveries, you say that the quote, it changed your archaeological destiny forever. Your sense of archaeology, your sense of your education. Tell me about the most revealing moment in your discovery of these amazing reliefs.
The most revealing moment? Well, that's an easy one, basically, Cliff. I was panning around with a remote sensing camera and looking at the many reflections that you get from the landscape below, the greens and grays and there's rock colors and all such. And passing across on one particular morning, I saw a very tiny pinpoint of light, and it was slightly incandescent. So, of course, to a researcher's eye, I mean, you can't pass by without finding out what it was. So I very, very carefully homed in onto this point of light. In fact, I completely froze for a few moments because I didn't want to lose it. I had a feeling that out somewhere down there was this shiny light, and I thought maybe it was silver deposit or a lake or something like that. As I homed in, there was this amazing image of a tiny, white, recumbent lamb. I mean, for heaven's sake, I thought, a lamb in the Andean highlands? Well, we know that sheep didn't arrive to at least the 16th century in Peru. So anyway, homed in, took the pictures, and noticed, of course, it was carved from white rock. It was probably dolerite, or even could be syenite, which is a very, very crystalline, almost marble brilliant rock. The head itself was facing rearwards, but slightly pointing southeast. Now, I saw a black patch was visible on the forehead, and a black spot was on the cheekbone. And it immediately reminded me of a religious icon. And again, I couldn't really believe it that was there. And I'll be quite honest with you, I actually left it for 3 days before I went back to have another peek, thinking that I had, you know, gone slightly gaga. But there it was. I measured it, 1,400 meters long by 1,000 meters high. It was a total shock. In this case, the cliff is actually a ram, because certain appendages give you the clue. And it was this colossal proportions. And I had to then investigate why it was there, what it was there, why was there a lamb in the high Andes mountains. And that really, really set my temper and impetus going, and to find out why it was there. But I accepted it. And so I scanned around the periphery, trying to think, well, would there be any writing or any other clues as to why it was there? Well, I bumped straight into a huge rock, which was carved in the form of an oryx or a mountain antelope, and that was not far from the sacred lamb. So here we are, one archaeological moment of a lifetime. Suddenly, you've got two archaeological moments of a lifetime, and this was unbelievable. But if you carry on and you read a little bit further, down into my book, you have the two human heads, etc., etc. And so the temple arena was containing five separate, huge, complete effigies. And one, in fact, which I call the altar stone, you can see, yes, it's amazing. It's amazing. You know, you cannot believe that you found one which the world might be interested in, but here you have a handful of five. And of course, that led me to begin to think in terms of, I have to put this in writing. So that was my archaeological moment of a lifetime, I can tell you. It changed my whole thinking, because here I was, an archaeoastronomer. I didn't really want pictures like this. I want to study the astronomy and the stars and why certain civilizations lived with this in mind. But here I was ditched with seven huge statues, and kind of wondering what I'd do with them. So, but that,
wow,
you know, started me going, and then I panned even further. And of course, that led me to finding all the other images as well. But that was my defining moment, to answer your question.
Fascinating. I want to move on to an area that you call, it's a massive scriptorium you discovered in 2009. Can you tell us about that, what that is, and where it's located?
Yes, I can. Indeed. Yeah. Well, it's located, I'm not sure how much of a map you have seen, actually, and it's very difficult without having a map in front of you. But if you have the map of the planetarium, which I sent up to you as promo, it's very close to the planetarium. So there are a bunch all together. And so what happened? Well, I would tell you, I continued scanning the area after I found the sacred temple. And I found an area which was a 500-meter length of white calcite rock. And beside the rock, there were a number of old buildings. And I just thought, well, maybe somebody lived there. And I took my scanning down, and I scanned along the length of the rock outcrop. And hey presto, I found four heads of a large size, and there's at least eight smaller heads on this particular plaza. Now, to answer your question about the scriptorium is only a few kilometers, as we say, down the road. And I scanned around to find if there was any buildings that would give me a clue who lived there and when they lived there, or any other artifacts. And I ran into this area of agricultural terracing. Well, you know, Cliff, that in that area there is agricultural terracing of virtually over the whole of that particular area, from Ayacucho down to the southern coast. And I accepted it, that's what it was. And just about to leave it, and I found an image of a man. And I thought, that's strange. Why is he there? And I managed to take a satellite picture, and he turned out to be the very first satellite picture I took of the region we're talking about now. And I was about to leave when I noticed the terracing had markings in the form of registers. And this was really strange, because having recognized now what Phoenician writing looks like, or Phoenician characters, I zoomed in on at least half a dozen areas, and that was covered in Phoenician writing. So here we have a scenario, agricultural terracing, of which Phoenician writing is carved in between the terracing cuts, or the we call the indents. And so, again, photographed it, looked at it, checked it out, definitely was Phoenician writing. So here we are again. And I measured the area, and it's something like about 7 square kilometers of allegedly Phoenician writing. You have to go careful when you say Phoenician writing, Cliff, because if we're dealing with a multiracial society, as we now know, we've got Chinese, we found the Arabs, we found the Greeks, we found the Phoenicians. So it tends to suggest there was a multiracial society there. We don't know precisely that language is pure Phoenician genre. So what we've got to do now is to get a team to go in and to clean the registers down and to expose even more of the writing If we can expose all the writing, then we have got one of the most magnificent records carved into the Sirenite or Dolerite that we could imagine, because I guess it would be the whole history of the new Phoenicians, New World Kingdom. We don't know how old the writing is on the basis when was it put there. Was it put there as the Phoenicians arrived or the multiracial societies arrived, or did they put it there as they were about to leave? Because you know, Cliff, that the area had desertification taking place from around about 800 BC onwards, and finally finished at about AD 690, when everyone appeared to leave and the Nazca people fell into disarray. So we don't quite know the absolute time span. The other thing is that under query at the moment, just to finish the dissertation on this, were the agricultural terraces first, and then, because of a rapid climate change, did they change them into a scriptorium because it was very convenient? The terraces gave the register, therefore they just carved in between the lines, as you can see from the photograph, or was it a purely original scriptorium carved into the base rock? So we don't know that yet. We've got to go there. We have to find out. So that was how I came to find the scriptorium.
Okay. Here I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that everyone, I'm sure, is curious about. Have you written any papers or published any papers to conventional archaeological journals? And I ask that because I'm curious to know what your peers have to say about your discovery. So what can you tell us on that?
At the moment, because we're in the interim period of not having carried out ground survey work on any of the discoveries in my book, where what we say is a project in motion. I have published certain material on my website which concerns this type of thing, but at the moment we haven't put it into a peer journal because they need more. We've actually been to Peru, we've spoken to people there, I'll go down to Lima, I know the Minister of Culture there quite well, but they to write a peer journal, you must do ground survey work to back up what is there. In other words, you have a question, just for example, how do we know that you haven't photoshopped all those images and made a book just because you want to make a pretty book and sell it for money?
Yeah.
And this is the now there is a very good argument to that. If you would like me to pontificate for just a little while on it, because in actual fact, it's a very, very important question. And,
Well, that's good. Yeah.
Okay, I'll just very quickly tell me how much time I've got left, because
We're getting down to our time. I guess the point I'm trying to make is, have you shown your research to any other archaeologists, anthropologists, anyone in the scientific field who is positive, feels that they are even potentially collaborate with you? What is the general consensus? Because to my mind, your research is not only groundbreaking and quite significant in its scope, it changes our understanding of intercontinental relations, the Phoenicians and other groups, Asian, African Americans, traveling oceans to South America, and it changes our understanding on a number of areas that radically makes us rethink history. And so, most of the time when I read something like yours, I almost predict a negative response from the scientific community. And I'm just curious if you've had a chance to introduce any of your work to and you have a substantial body of work. You not only have you documented it and ground photograph. You've documented it with satellite imagery too. So have you been able to do any presentations or meet with any groups or anybody else?
Yes, we have presented copies of Portraits of the Gods to people in various eminent places, but it always appears to be the one thing is that it needs to be backed up. Well, I'm not trying to sell something that is not being verified because it's a project in motion. We know that we have to have certain teams to go out and examine the seven major sites just in a preliminary way to start a ball rolling to get funding. Yes, I have been down to Peru. I have spoken to people about this, and it's always the same thing. Archaeology, we have no money to spare. Anyway, you haven't been there to do any research. And I did actually try at one university to whether they would help me put out an archaeological team just to do some preliminary work. And the answer was no, we don't have any money for that. You have to do it yourself.
Right.
So what we're doing, so this will answer your question, is we are now planning a funding program, and we're going to divide it up into six or seven teams who will have enough money, because most of this work I've backed myself over the years. And what we do, we'll have a small team go in, and we actually do have someone in Peru, I won't quote his name at the moment, who has been willing to oversee the whole thing, the whole project, when we get the project moving. So what we've got to do now is we have to go out for funding. As if funding, it shouldn't be too much of a problem, Cliff, because we've got European, we've got Mediterranean countries, we've got the Near East, the Middle East, the Far East, South America, Peru, Brazil, Uruguay, that we can go to. It's not like one little archaeological site in the middle of the Andes Mountains. This has a multiracial international interest. And I think once we can now push it like via your program, I think the response could be quite good. And then we will be in a position that later on we can get it cleared by a peer journal. But I'm happy with the progress we've made so far. And I'm very keen on moving into the second phase.
It's almost as if it would be a television, a National Geographic program that they would fund to actually take some of your research and make it into a 1-hour special.
Great. Well,
why not? Well,
Cliff, actually, you jumped the gun ever so slightly, and I, excuse me, it's time for a glass of wine. We actually did have a certain person who took it over to the Lebanon, and she took the details to a meeting of which National Geographic actually attended, and they came back and said, you haven't enough material. That was at that time, 3 years ago, that would warrant making an hour's documentary. But if you can compile more material and put it together, then come back in 2 years' time and they will possibly have an interest. As you quite rightly say, we've got so much material, and with respect, you've only seen the material which is in my book, Portraits. But if you look at my registers, I mean, they're full of Phoenician writing and more images, as I say. So I've got a lot of material for a good documentary. In fact, I toyed with the idea of making a video and putting that out, like on your podcast or something like that.
Oh, we'd be happy to support you if you had a video that you wanted to have funded. And also, there's various sites that you can post a project and get money for in terms of funding. So anyhow, we're getting down to the final minutes, and I do want to talk about the planetarium the linear observatory that I have seen found by other researchers, but you have actually discovered a tremendous amount of information regarding this outdoors observatory. First of all, what part of Peru is it located at? And and then tell us a little bit about this observatory and why it's so unique. It's quite large, isn't it? It's big.
Yes, indeed it is. Well, firstly, I won't go back to the Nazca lines too much, but within the Nazca lines, there are what they call zigzag geoglyphs. And they were put down to be pure graffiti. Well, they're not actually. They are linear observatories. And I was the first person to proclaim that they are astronomically inclined. Now, zooming from the Nazca lines, let's go to the linear observatory firstly. Now, a linear observatory, as you know, is in fact nothing more than a stone circle, which in fact is stretched out in a single line. And so it's a conventional stone circle, which has a number of stone markers, and they're placed at intervals around the circumference. And as you know, each stone relates to a point on the distant horizon, which could be like the solstices or the equinoxes or the rising and setting points of the moon or even certain stars. Now, a linear observatory functions exactly the same, except the markers are stretched out in a straight line, as we discovered. Mm-hmm. And I discovered this linear observatory by zooming around with Google Earth. There was 15 circles, and Sonia and myself flew out to Peru, and we took the photographs, again, which are exhibited in Portraits of the Gods, and we actually photographed the site. So we know, A, the site is there, so, you know, we didn't Photoshop it. And the other thing that we checked was that if you take any one of the 15 circles that form the linear observatory, and you look across to the mountainside, you will notice that there are certain small rounded stones, what we call them domes, that are in lines. Well, what we did, we took the azimuth of each of these stone lines, and we found that they in fact were connected to the solstices, the equinoxes, etc. In other words, they were astronomically aligned. Now, my belief is that this particular linear observatory is a tool that was used to create maybe even the original pattern of the Nazca lines, but certainly they would use it on the planetarium. Now, the reason I say that is quite simple, because with the linear observatory, you can see where you're going. You can see the horizon. You can see the azimuthal stretching out or alignments. But if you go to the planetarium, this is a different ballgame. We discovered the planetarium by scanning and plotting wherever we found an image. And coincidentally, those images happened to form straight lines, or what we call line centers, which is a term devised by Tony Avini. So the map you have, which I think we actually did send to you, and you can see in your book, we now have line centers with azimuths spreading out from each, like a star center. Now, because it's on a mountainous terrain and not a flat, level playing field, you can't see the huacas or the images wherever you go. You can walk across the line and then you can see them, and you walk a bit further and you bump into a mountaintop or a valley. So they are on, in other words, uneven terrain. Now, that means that you could not use that landscape planetarium as a measuring device for astronomical recording. So my way of thinking is that these images are placed along the line rather like the huacas and the sicas, which was promoted by Tom Zudema. And so therefore you have the difference. The linear observatory further down the valley, because it's not all that far away, just down the valley, is the working tool. And the planetarium was devised using that working tool, because you could then plot what you already knew, the solstices, the various stars, the moon, moon rise and moon setting points. So the linear observatory was used for that tool. Interestingly, to prove the point, if you take a transparency of the linear observatory, if you take a transparency of the Nazca lines, and you take a transparency of the planetarium, they all match, which means they were all produced generally at the same time. I know it's a bone of contention trying to date Asimovs, but they all match. Mm-hmm. And so they
What is matching? What part is matching, William? Are similar in length, or they connect via Go ahead.
Well, the angles of the sun and the moon and the various stars all match the same angles on the Nazca Desert. In other words, they're astronomically aligned exactly. So your center point aligns with that on the Nazca Desert, et cetera, et cetera.
Very good.
Which is fairly logical if you, in fact, were producing something in that area. They must have to be the same. Otherwise, if they're not, they're not astronomical alignments. It means they're just random lines that someone drew. But these prove that they are astronomical alignments. So that's why the three. So that's the difference, Cliff, very short, between the planetarium and the linear observatory. The planetarium will be, I think, a spiritual device. We don't know they are huacas because we have to go and look to see if they're votive offerings. As you know, that's what a huaca is. And we have contact with someone in Lima who is going to do the linear observatory and do the ground survey and prove that what we're saying, in fact, is dead right. Although, how are you going to move 200 or 300 rounded stones all into a different place to prove it doesn't work? I don't know. But they're very good people there. So that's your difference, to answer your question, between the two.
Okay. Let's take a question here. This is in from John in New Mexico. He asks and writes, has there been any excavations around any of the regions where you have discovered these reliefs? And I guess he means, have they discovered remains of Phoenician boats, crafts, pottery, whatever? That's from John in New Mexico.
No, the answer to John in Mexico, no, the answer is quite simple, really. No, there has been no excavation permitted by the Ministry of Culture whatsoever. You have to get a special certificate to do that. I have a license to overfly, but you are not permitted to excavate without the permission of the Ministry of Culture. And as it's basically a new project, we have to prove what we're saying is there, and then we have to have a ministry archaeologist in attendance before we can make any excavation. So, Sean, the answer is no, not yet.
That's quite interesting. So that they make it very difficult to actually you have to have special permission and permit, and then you're telling me you have to have one of their people along with you then, huh?
Yes, you cannot excavate at all anywhere in Peru without a license, and they're very hard to get as well from the Ministry of Culture. And I personally know the people that operate the system, and yes, it's very, very difficult.
Why would they make it so difficult if you have a significant discovery to reveal? Or do they only want university-level excavation going on? Is that what you suspect?
Well, basically you do need experienced people, and the teams that I was mentioning to, I would put together, they would be specialized people. We wouldn't use any random public people to go and do any digging. Well, in fact, you wouldn't be able to dig. All we really need is a ground survey to start with. We just want to field walk it, see if we can find some artifacts, find out, say, for example, in the scriptorium, can we just look at the figures that are uncovered, what are they like, what are they made up, how deep are they cut in there, where are the agricultural terraces, da-di-da-di-da. And no, it's not easy, but you see the pilfering and the robbing that goes on in Peru for artifacts, because, well, there are poor people, and we all have to live somehow, but unfortunately the artifacts are at the mercy. And as we've known in the past, there are literally hundreds of places that have been looted. And so I am not declaring until the Ministry of Culture give me permission to declare where the sites are, because by that we can strangle a multiplicity of diggings all over the place. We can control it within our limits. And as you know, from one site to another, they can be contemporaneous. Therefore, we don't have to dig every site. we can get a pattern by doing a small amount to start with. But if we can raise the awareness in Peru for a site like this, then the advantage to the tourist industry would be tremendous. But you've got to remember, Peru has got to somehow has got to cope with, just say, for example, it blows, and we've got the site, which we've got the plaza there, we've got the scriptorium there, we've got the linear observatory, we've got the planetarium, all in one place. Suddenly you get hotels, boarding houses, traffic everywhere, architectural erosion to the air. And so I'm a member of the Nazca Lines Preservation Society, so I'm very much aware of what damage can happen. And I've done archaeological digging as well, and I've seen it happen.
Wow. We just got a couple of minutes left, and I want to ask you, this is a fascinating subject, and The Portrait of the Gods is a wonderful book. I've read most of it. What is your you said you are working on a second book. Is that a follow-up in terms of additional discoveries, or is there something that you have uncovered that you felt was worthy of another book?
The next one on the Portrait of Gods series will be a follow-up, because in the meantime of having written the book, as you can imagine, progress changes things. You make new discoveries. Your theories and thoughts perhaps behind what you've discovered changes. You read things. You talk to people. You do investigations. Mm-hmm. So it will be an update of Portraits of the Gods. But I am preparing another book which involves a site which I found in Uruguay. And this is to do with the epigraphy discovered in that particular site, which is absolutely amazing. So maybe I can tell you now or another day.
We're going to have to do another program, I think, William. I think we're going to have to do another program.
I would love to. I would absolutely love to. Please, can we have some video in the program so that your listeners and your viewers can see the pictures that you and I have tried to describe just on the radio, and they're all thinking, my God, I wonder what that really looks like. But they could go and buy a book, couldn't they?
Yes. I encourage you to get the book. You can get the book at William's website. It's Nazcodex. Is it nazcodex.com? Why don't you give us what's the website?
Hello?
Hello, Sonia. Hey. Yes, Sonia.
Hello.
Why don't you give us website? I'm going to publish it on the Facebook page and on the blog talk, but give us the website where people can get a copy of your book, Portraits of the Gods.
Yes. You can go on nazcodexpublications.com. Then you will see all the details for downloading the ebook from iTunes or ordering us a hardcover copy. Or the last thing to do is a PDF version. So
okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. If someone were to go to iPhone or iTunes and they punch in Portraits of the Gods, can they?
Yeah.
Will that take it to them? Will that take them to the actual ebook?
Yes, to iTunes store, and they can buy the iBook for Apple devices only.
Okay. So to get the ebook in a format for PCs, they have to go to nazcodex.com.
Yes, they now is ready for downloading on PDF only, because there are so many varieties of ebooks for different devices that we prefer to keep the PDF instead of trying to produce another electronic book for PCs.
Okay. So Sonia is telling us that other than the Apple, iTunes version, if you don't have an Apple computer, you're going to have to download it, but it's in a PDF format, which is universally available and visually available to most computers. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yeah.
Okay. And when will you be publishing the hardbound copy of the book?
is in the same website. All is in the NASCODEXpublications.com.
Okay, very good.
You will see the
all
three
right.
the three versions. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Okay, can we speak to William again, and we're just about done with our show here.
Okay.
Thank you, Sonia.
Okay, Cliff, I'm back again, yeah.
Okay, well, great, William.
Okay.
So in the last minute or two, again, I think you got some amazing discovery here. What would you like to conclude with? We'll give you a couple of minutes. Why don't you have some concluding remarks about your discovery and why you feel it's a significant and anything you want to say. A couple minutes to go. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, it is significant from the point of view that all of the material has never been filmed. It's before. It's a new technology. The satellite technology is new. It means that you can do many, many more things by, if you like to say in quotes, sitting in your armchair at home. Anyone can do it. They can have fun doing it. Grab yourself a Google Earth, travel around the world, look at the monuments of the world, all the things that maybe you never have a chance to see. And this is how I started, and here I am now, so many years on, 40 years on, that I've found an interest that I never believed would ever happen to me. I cannot believe it happened. I still read my registers, and I still cannot believe that amount of material I could take out of one region that no one knew about. It's totally, totally virgin territory. So it's wide open to making new discoveries, and this is why I want to keep it closed and virgin for a while until we can get a team of experts together and we can find out what Bill Veal says is true or otherwise.
Very good. Fantastic.
Cliff.
Well, William, thank
yep.
you for being on the program, and I invite you to join us again, come back again sometime when you have got more evidence, more proof, more data that you find. Maybe just before your new book comes out, we'll
yeah.
have you on the
yep.
program again. So thank you.
Thank you very
for
much.
Joining us.
Yeah.
Okay.
I accept your invitation. I enjoyed so much being on your program and to being able to talk to you. So thank you very,
wonderful.
Very much indeed. And we say good night from here now. And Sonia says good night. Well, it is our
good night
time now, and good night to Sonia. Yeah. So, okay,
very Cliff. Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Steve.
You.
Bye bye for now.
Bye. So that was William Veal, and that is, I think, a significant discovery that we'll probably hear more about. As we have known, and as I have known, most Orthodox archaeological departments, be it large or small, departments, universities just do not have the funds to do the significant research that needs to take place to open this up to a larger audience. As a reminder, next week my guest is Robert Bouval, who will be coming from the United States. He'll be here, and this is a unique chance to hear from him and his new research and discovery of the Great Pyramid and the Giza pyramids as a whole. And I'm looking forward to speaking with him directly. So have a great day, and we will talk to you and hear from you, and I hope you'll join us next week.